It was the whole Super Bowl.
Okay, back on the record. Mr. Zimser, call your next witness.
The company calls Mr. Stephen Wishart.
Mr. Wishart, you've been here the whole time, so you've heard the admonition. I'll just have you raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding? Thank you.
Mr. Wishart, I don't have much by way of questions, but Mr. Alders did mention, as we were going through some of the company's decisions today, that at some point, the company has to exercise its judgment as to what makes the best resource to meet its needs. And as Director of Resource Planning, I was wondering if you can walk us through the company's analysis of the different options it had as part of the Minnesota proceedings and how it arrived at its recommendation.
Sure. You're correct. In my role, I was heavily involved in the analysis and making recommendations to upper-level management regarding which projects we were identifying as being the least cost for customers. I think the best place to probably start would be in it's the second attachment to Mr. Alders' testimony.
So that would be Schedule 2 to Exhibit 5.
Take your word for it. Schedule 2 will take Exhibit 5. And then going back even further, maybe you can help me out with...
I believe it would be Schedule 4 to Schedule 2 to Exhibit 5.
What? Thank you. I didn't know if that was on.
It would be Mr. Alders' testimony, and it would be Steve Richards. Direct in Minnesota.
Okay. No, isn't it? Oh.
And it'll have the Schedule 4 in the top right corner.
I'm going to the stuff you handed out today. All
right. Yeah, it should be in there.
Schedule 2, their supplemental. Page what?
This would be Schedule
89.
4, so it'd be 89.
Okay.
Pass.
Oh. What page?
The page numbers jump all over.
Pages numbers are listed in the upper right hand corner. Page 3 of 10 is where I'd like to start. It says 3 of 10 in the upper right hand corner and page 91 of 98 in the upper left hand corner. The title of the chart is Calpine Mankato versus Black Dog 6. Okay. Starting with our comparison of Calpine Mankato versus Black Dog 6, I'd like to start off by saying the price of the Calpine Mankato project was the lowest combined cycle pricing that I've seen in any of the jurisdictions within XL that I've worked in. I've been in resource planning 7-8 years now, working in all of our jurisdictions, including Colorado and Texas and New Mexico. And the price of the Calpine project was well below what we thought market price for combined cycle was. Part of that is, as discussed earlier, is that it was essentially a half-built plant at that point. They designed it to be a certain size, built it halfway, and so they only had this incremental addition to put on. And, my educated opinion is that that's really why they were able to offer such a low price, because they were halfway to the finish line already. So what this chart shows, the line and bar chart at the top, attempts to illustrate the year-by-year cost impacts that we are seeing. And it illustrates the difference in cost between the Calpine offering and our Black Dog 6 project. The periodic bars represent annual costs. The red line is cumulative net present value of those bars. What you'll see is in the years 2019 through 2035, when both the Black Dog CT and the Calpine project are in play, that Black Dog has a small cost savings over Calpine in those years. Those small bars going up represent a small savings for the Black Dog project. The reason Black Dog's lower cost is because it's only a CT, we can build it a little bit cheaper than they can. Calpine's competitive because although the annual fixed cost might be a little bit higher, the efficiency of their unit brings it back into close competition. The second thing to notice on this graph is all the large bars on the far right. This is the long-term natural gas assumption that Mr. Alders or Ms. McCartan alluded to earlier. And what this is, this shows our baseline assumption about what happens when Calpine PPA contract retires. At the end of 20 years, what do we do about that expiring PPA? Our customers will still be on our system, we'll still have to meet our reserve margin standards. So what I did in my analysis is I had the model add a brand new CT to replace that. So, and by that time, a brand new CT, you can imagine in 2037, a brand new power plant is going to be considerably more expensive than they are today, just based on general inflation. So we see this big line of bars on the far right. We've been calling it the fan. So based on this analysis, I concluded to myself and presented to management at our company that over the contract life, Black Dog is competitive with this combined cycle. And then we have these long-term benefits that we're also seeing. Moving on to the analysis of the Red River One Valley Project. Flip a few pages forward. It's page 7 of 10. The title of it is Red River Valley Unit 1 versus Calpine Mankato. Now you have to kind of flip your axis of orientation here because first one was Calpine versus Red River. This one's Red River versus Calpine, so the axis is flipped. When you see those small bars in the 2019 through 2035 time frame, those are actually higher costs for the Red River Valley units. So during the lifetime of the Calpine contract, based on our baseline analysis, we actually show Red River Valley to be higher costs. You know, those lines or those bars appear to be in between the 10 and 0 line. So, you know, anywhere from, I'd eyeball it as $7 to $2 million per year. Over the life of a 20-year contract, you can see how that could add up to upwards of $100 million nominal. You'll notice that red line, it's hidden behind the box in the middle, but that's in the, you know, a positive net impact of about $40 million in the 2035 time frame. It's not until we get to that long-term benefit when the contract expires and I made the assumption that it gets replaced by a brand new unit out in that time frame where you really see that red line start to come down significantly. That's how we get to the long-term conclusion that the PVRR or NPV is only a $2 million difference. So I see the Black Dog and the Red River is very different, although they maybe the PVRRs aren't all that different. From my analysis, I concluded that Black Dog can be a savings in every year of the 20-year contract, whereas Red River Valley would actually be a cost adder for the first 20 years, and we would be relying on some of these very long-term benefits to justify the economics of the unit. And that assumption that I make about the long term is uncertain, and I think it was alluded to earlier. It's not so much the price of natural gas as a commodity. It's the cost of replacement capacity in that time frame because it's really replacement of the PPA that's driving those big bars. One possibility, and it's something I show in the sensitivity table, is that it's possible that the PPAs will renew their contract at the end of those 20 years. At the end of 20 years, those still should be viable plants if they kept them in good working order, and they'd probably be in line for another 10-year extension or so, which would significantly decrease those long-term benefits that we're seeing out there and therefore significantly increase the NPV impact of the Red River Valley units. Does that help?
Yeah.
Good. That is very helpful, Mr. Wishart. Would that same analysis with the Calpine Mankato that you just walked through apply to what's on page 6 of 10 with the Red River Valley Unit 1 versus Invenergy Cannon Falls?
Very similar analysis. We'll see on the previous page, page 6 of 10, Red River Valley Unit 1 versus Invenergy Cannon Falls, that Red River Valley does catch up in a few years, years 2032 through 2035. Red River Valley did manage to overtake the economics of Invenergy. But we still see those front-end loaded costs, especially the front-end loaded cost. 2019, it looks like an incremental $10 million, and that's a $10 million rate case that we'd have to bring in front of the commission. And that's something we, we do strive to avoid. We do try to keep our total costs as low as possible, and these near-term cost impacts are something we try to keep an eye on.
Mr. Wishart, I notice in both of these in 2049, there seems to be a reversal. What is that indicating?
2049?
Yeah.
It's the changing around of some of the generic units in the tail. One plan would be building one unit, while another plan would be delaying building that unit by 1 year.
And is it this year-on-year-in impact that really is also driving some of the company's choices for recommendations for how to meet its resource needs?
Could you repeat the question?
Sure. Is this type of analysis where you look at the impact on, in each year and how that may have an impact on rates and customers an important part of your analysis when selecting resources?
It is. When we come up with a single PVRR or PVSC number, that's convenient to put into a chart and into testimony. When we really make our decision-making process, we do look at these year-by-year details. Below, you'll notice I've classified all the costs into different buckets. So we'll try to identify when cost impacts are occurring, what the cost impacts, what the drivers are, whether it's the capacity payments or whether it's fuel savings. So we do look at all these things when we make a decision. We don't simply just jump to the single NPV number, although that is a convenient way to communicate our analysis.
In addition to those analyses that you've just walked through, you do also perform a sensitivity analysis, correct?
Correct. Back on page 39, I believe it was. And this is a table of the sensitivity analysis we conducted in the case of this competitive acquisition process. We don't change every variable in the model. There's literally hundreds. What we do try to do is identify the ones that we know will have the most impact on the results. And I'd like to draw your attention to the second from last column on the right. It's titled PPA Extensions. Oh, page 39.
Of your testimony.
Exhibit 5, Schedule 2, page 39. It's page
41
of
98.
Okay. I think I got it.
Okay. So the column second to the far right, it's called PPA Extension. And instead of making the assumption that once the PPAs retire, they're replaced with a brand new unit in 2037, we make the assumption that the PPAs are extended for another 10 years after their original expiration date. And what you will see is that on the third line, the Red River Valley, the cost of that really increases. And that's not the only piece of information we based our decision on, but that gave us an indication that there's a possibility if those PPAs are extended at the end of their lives that the Red River Valley unit could lose a significant amount of its value on an NPV basis. Also on this table, on the second column from the left, titled High Gas, you'll see in line 2 a negative $27 million. This indicates that under a high gas scenario, that Calpine-Mankato combined cycle has a significant cost advantage. The reason being combined cycles are more fuel efficient. Therefore, if natural gas prices are high, those units become more valuable because they'll burn less gas per megawatt hour. That's another item that we based our decision making on. We all, fracking has brought a lot of natural gas to the market. Currently, prices are low, but we all lived through, 2000, 2005 through 2007 or 8, when prices, you know, spiked all the way up to $10. And that's not a lesson that's lost on us yet at this point. We keep that in mind, and we always, you know, think about a rebound in gas prices as a potential issue for our customers that we try to manage.
And just to be clear, Mr. Wishart, what this Table 9 is showing is the, if you were to change one of your assumptions, the delta in price, in perceived cost of that plan? Is that correct?
That's correct. This illustrates what happens to the net results when we change one assumption at the time. And we recognize that all the variables can change all at once, but to really identify what the impact of just changing one, we do it one at a time.
And Project 1 is your baseline for that?
So correct.
So the cost of Invenergy plus Black Dog 6 plus whatever the number is in the chart?
Correct.
Okay. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Norrell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Mr. Wishart.
Afternoon.
We're talking about 20-year PPAs in the Minnesota cap process. Is that correct?
The two PPAs that we're considering right now, Invenergy Cannon Falls and Calpine Mankato, yes, those were 20-year PPAs. The GRE proposal was shorter. That was 2 or 3 years. I think we had an option on that one.
Okay. That actually, you kind of jogged my memory on that, too. Why, if, you know, we've heard some talk from the company about waiting to see, why doesn't the company look at going with that GRE short-term purchase of credits and addressing this in another year or two?
Yeah, you'll see in the results that the GRE plans or portfolios that contain the GRE proposal are near the top. And what that, you know, that reflects the fact that the price of these credits are about the price of these contracts that are under consideration. And in the company's decision-making process, we think, well, we can have a pile of paper credits that really add nothing to the system, or we can actually have some steel at the ground that can be turned on to meet peak demand. And when we, you know, looking at that, to go with paper credits, we'd really want to see a much more substantial discount, you know, maybe half the cost of building an actual plant, because the paper credits don't really help you for anything but complying with your MISO reserve margin. So we wanted to see a much bigger discount out of the GRE capacity credit option.
What's the length in the model? What's the proposed length of the CTs that we're looking at here for Black Dog 6 and both Red River Valley units?
We did model those with a 35-year life.
5-year life. What's the oldest combustion term in the company's fleet right now?
I can speak about Minnesota specific or the NSP system specific. On page... Here we go again. My rebuttal testimony.
So that would be Schedule 3 of Mr. Alden's testimony.
Schedule 3 on page 11. It says 11 on the bottom and page 13 of 47 in the upper left hand corner. I'm sorry about that.
Why are there so many numbers? It's so funny. Okay.
On the, that's, you have it. On that page, I do list 5 peakers that are currently operating on the NSP system. You can see that their in-service dates range between 1969 and 1974.
So it would be possible that Black Dog 6 and the two Red River Valley units could even exceed the 25-year proposal.
We modeled with a 35-year lifetime, and I think it's possible that question is probably better directed to Greg. He's our ENC expert, knows more about power plants than I do. He'll probably be able to elaborate better than I can.
One of the questions that's been brought up earlier was the driver of the drivers of growth, load growth in the system, in the company's system. Do you know where those would be located? Are those Minnesota, North Dakota? How are those broken out?
In our load forecasting, we do break it into jurisdiction, and all the jurisdictions are growing. We're seeing positive load growth in all of them. Actually, South Dakota, on a percentage basis, is seeing the largest growth, but I think that has a lot to do with it starts off very small. So a few megawatts growth there, it turns into a big percentage. And same with Wisconsin. Wisconsin's seeing healthy growth from normal sand mines to support some of the fracking. So we are seeing load growth in all of our jurisdictions.
The company came before the commission with looking for combustion turbines, ADP on combustion turbines, but you guys are looking at a combined cycle with Calpine. Why are you willing to accept a combined cycle there instead of self-building combined cycle if there, you showed in one of the earlier tables the economic benefits?
Sure. It all started with our resource plan. Through our resource planning process, we identified that actually the economics of peaking and intermediate were fairly close together. When we looked at which combined cycle intermediate type plants that we could build internally versus what kind of peaking units we could build internally, we identified that our best proposal could be a peaking unit. Although we continue to acknowledge that combined cycle versus peaking remained relatively close. And the reason the peaking was the best offer that we could propose is we've talked a lot about timing uncertainty, right? The nice thing about these CTs is that we can build them in 200 megawatt increments and kind of slide the in-service dates to best match load. With a combined cycle, we think our most cost-effective combined cycle alternative would be a big 800 megawatt two-on-one plant. So that's big 800 megawatts that all have to come online all at once to be cost effective. And we thought, you know, to do our best to mitigate, you know, rate increases, that this CT proposal was the best option that we could have. But all along, recognized that intermediate wasn't, combined cycle wasn't far off. And when we opened up the competitive process, we did acknowledge that fact and, you know, thought it was okay for peaking and intermediate to bid in.
What's the size of the Calpine combined cycle unit that's being proposed?
They're proposing an incremental addition of 345 megawatts winter, and then the summer rated capacity, I believe, is 289. I have it listed here in one of my tables. And there was some discussion in our hearing in Minnesota regarding exactly what the summer number was, but 289.
Do you know how many minutes it would take to get that unit up to full power from a cold start or completely offline?
Combined cycles do take longer to get up to full load. I think the metric we really like to look at is how fast can they get synchronized to the grid. Up and running and synchronized to the grid, which is about 50% capacity. And for a combined cycle like that, it can take over 30 minutes to reach that point.
And what are the size of the units the company's planning to install at Black Dog and Red River Valley? Is that 210?
Their summer rated capacity is 200. Well, there's lots of ways to measure this. Summer rated capacity, 215.
How many minutes does it take these simple cycle units to get up and running?
My understanding is it's about 5 minutes. But again, Greg Ford can probably tell you a little bit more about their starting capability.
In February of 2002 in Colorado, there was a major wind ramp down event. Are you familiar with this event?
Vaguely, yes.
There was an estimated about 500 megawatts of wind that tripped offline in about 30 minutes. With a combined cycle, how could you respond to that?
If you only had combined cycle, it would be very difficult. Actually, I think it's an interesting situation. In Colorado, the Denver area is very rich in local generation resources, but very limited in its outside transmission line and infrastructure. If you just had a combined cycle alone, it'd be very difficult. Peaking resources will contribute to your ability to react to changes in variable generation resources, but also your transmission interconnection helps immensely. MISO is such a large interconnected grid that one single unit really won't make or break the whole system's ability to react to wind. And what we've found since joining MISO is MISO has been fantastic at integrating variable generation resources. The amount of spinning reserves that we keep online, spinning reserves are kind of keeping one unit at half speed so it can quickly react to any changes. We've actually found that those, our spinning reserve requirements have gone down because we can rely on our MISO neighbors in that way.
I just had a question, kind of going back to our conversations in the rate case. There was some discussion in your testimony about meeting MISO's regional peak, and I was kind of confused about that. Is that a single peak, or is that, what is that regional peak? What does that mean? Is that an annual, quarterly?
Oh, okay. What we plan to in the NSP region is to meet our peak during summer, so it's the annual peak. We do plan around other months. And we do this in a few ways. I can give examples. We have a diversity contract with Manitoba Hydro where, recognizing that our winter needs are lower, in the summer we get 350 megawatts from them, and in the winter, recognizing we don't need as many megawatts, we send several 350 megawatts to them. In the winter, we also have several units that don't have firm gas supply. Therefore, they're unavailable during the winter. Blue Lake 7 and 8 and Anson 4. We recognize that paying the extra firm gas contracts on those wouldn't be economic for our customers because we would have excess length in the winter that really isn't needed. And also maintenance scheduling comes into that a lot. Recently, just for regular maintenance, I noticed on one of our daily reports that we had about 2,000 megawatts of units out for their fall, regular maintenance. All plants have to go through them, but we schedule them in non-peak months so we can, balance out reliability throughout the year. But it is just one summer peak that we plan to.
That's what the capacity factor is based off of, is that one summer peak?
That's the capacity need, yes.
At other points in your testimony, you had talked about demand-side management. And I was just wondering, what kind of programs does the company have currently with its North Dakota ratepayers for DSM? And you'd also mentioned there's looking at DSM going forward. Do you know what they're looking at?
I'm sorry. Actually, I'm not familiar with what specific programs we offer in North Dakota. I know moving forward, we are concerned that all the easy DSM has been taken. We changed out all the really inefficient lighting that we could, and there's also federal standards coming down that says, that completely outlaws some of the old technology as far as lighting and motors, and that makes it hard for us to find new stuff that we can do. So we're always going to be looking, and if there's additional opportunities in North Dakota, I think we'd explore those.
Do you think that the commission, is it appropriate for the commission to try and order demand-side management, or is that something that should be entered into with the customers and the company separately from the commission?
I think the commission could establish kind of a goal or a target, but then on an individual basis, it really has to be a one-off. We look at, your cooling system in your warehouse to determine what kind of motors that we could help you install and what kind of rebate level would be appropriate. So there's a lot of customer to company one-on-one contact that needs to happen there.
We've heard a lot about the cost savings, about going with these PPAs. And again, I had asked this question to Ms. McCartan earlier, and I'll ask it to you. Does cost drive everything, or what role does the energy security, the grid stabilization, the proximity to load, what role does that play in determining the type of resource?
When we're looking to add a resource, it's really the singular company peak that we need to meet. So that's the first objective. But we do look at, regional local reliability issues. One example I have is northern Wisconsin. Northern Wisconsin is served by a fairly weak 115 kV transmission system. And it's currently, there is some currently some generation there. It's called Bayfront. It's an old coal unit, about total about 50 megawatts, actually converted to biomass, actually burns everything, like old railroad ties. It's kind of an amazing old plant. But it was facing the same MATS and EPA rules that our Black Dog 3 and 4 units were looking at. And under normal circumstances, we may have chosen to retire that unit. But because it is critical to the local grid, we decided to keep that unit running. We had another example it's not in the NSP service territory, but down in our SPS service territory, a town called Tucumcari. That was served by a single radial line, just one line going into the city, which is not the situation we have in Fargo. Fargo served by 7 or 8 different incoming transmission lines. Recognizing that having just one single transmission line would be an issue, we made sure there was a generator in Tucumcari. So regional reliability does come into play in our decision-making process. But it's just that we haven't identified the Fargo area as being critically in need of additional generation to ensure reliability. Currently, we're meeting all of our reliability metrics around the area. So while local generation does enhance reliability, we haven't identified a need to enhance local reliability at this point. But we'd be open to exploring this issue further.
So enhanced reliability, what other kind of benefits would there be of local generation? Specifically, I guess, with Fargo. Can you testify to any that there might be?
A job creation wouldn't be very high on the list. The plants like that employ just a handful of people. During construction, you'd get a few more construction jobs, but those will only be short-lived. So other than a minor increase in reliability from a level of reliability that we already think is pretty good, I couldn't identify any additional.
I think it was in the rate case you and I had a conversation about line loss. And in that conversation, I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was determined that North Dakota has a higher rate of line loss than Minnesota and South Dakota. Can you recall, is that correct?
The further distance energy has to travel through a line, the more the losses will be. I will note that most of line losses that you experience are actually in the distribution system. Going through the high, 345 kV system, you lose a relatively small amount of energy, and it's really most of the losses occur in the distribution system just because you have smaller lines at lower voltages.
Wouldn't it stand to reason, though, that local generation would lead to lower line loss in North Dakota?
When the units are running, these are peaking units. We don't expect these to run very much, maybe 5% of the year. So the other 95% of the year, the line losses, I don't think would be changed.
Did you happen to factor in the decrease in line loss in your strategist models for that 5% at all?
We did not. We do not attempt. Line losses would be represented by the local marginal price for energy, the LMPs. And we do not attempt to do long-term forecasts of LMPs at each specific place in our system for the simple fact that it's very suspect. And right now we're seeing fairly consistent LMPs within our service territory. We don't see the diverging.
We had the tables that you'd shown earlier on Schedule 4 to Exhibit 2 to, or Schedule 4 to Schedule 2 to Exhibit 5. Yes. those had used the term PVSC. Could you explain for us what PVSC is?
Present value of societal costs. And because this was originally filed in Minnesota, we are required to add some carbon hedge numbers and some small externalities associated with SO2 and some other particulates. So when we include those, PVRR becomes PVSC.
On Table 9, which is page 39 of Schedule to Mr. Alders, to Exhibit 5.
Yes, sir.
Can you identify which column in there would be the PVRR?
In page 9?
Table 9.
Table 9.
Page 39.
Okay.
Yes.
The sensitivity analysis table. The closest thing would be the zero CO2.
And which the baseline would still be Invergy Cannon Falls, is that correct?
The baseline would be a combination of Invergy and Black Dog, correct.
And then number 2, which is the proposed PPA with Calpine Mankato, what's that plus 23 mean in that column?
It means that if you did Calpine instead of Invergy, but still doing Black Dog in both situations, that the total net NPV cost would be $23 million higher.
And what about plan number 3, which includes Red River Valley 1?
That would show that Red River Valley would be, plus that GRE short-term purchase, would be $3 million more expensive than the Invergy project.
So under PVRR, a Red River Valley 1 plan would be very competitive with
the Invergy. It would be. That has the same long-term versus short-term issue that we discussed before when we were looking at the bar charts. That $3 million of closeness does depend on that long-term assumption that at the end of 20-year PPA with Invergy, that it gets replaced with an expensive new, brand-new 2037 plant.
Do you happen to have any of those long-term charts just showing PVRR as opposed to PVSC?
I do not. Overall, I expect that the emissions costs in there would be relatively small. I don't know if we could pick up a visual change even, but we could work on developing those for you.
That would be very helpful because one of the concerns is that, as was discussed with the Big Stone 2 ADP years ago, these environmental externalities are illegal to be considered by the commission. And so I just would like the commission to take note of that as well. And I'm sure the company was aware of that.
Understood, but when we're comparing gas to gas, we find these other numbers for environmental factors to be considerably smaller than maybe in a coal case.
I think that concludes all of my questions.
Mr. Armstrong.
If we could just stay on the sensitivity chart for now, I'm looking at plan number 5, and that's Black Dog 6 with just Red River Valley 1, which does not include the GRE short term. And under the $0 CO2, which I think is the closest to PVRR, that also appears to be $13 million less expensive than plan 2, is that correct?
Number 5 versus number 2 under zero CO2. That would indicate that the Red River Valley is $13 million less expensive than the Calpine Mankato unit, but $10 million more expensive than the Invergy Cannon Falls project.
And what? I didn't catch all the tables right at the beginning of your testimony.
Sorry.
I didn't see in any of them, those I page through, a comparison with Plan 3 or even Plan 5 with another one. Did I miss that, or?
There may have been. My purpose of creating those tables was really try to create head-to-head matchups between each one of the project proposals. So there should be a table that compares. This would be a direct comparison between Red River Valley and the Calpine Mankato project, and that is one of the tables I went through. So the comparison is in there somewhere.
So could you just explain to us why, I guess, you think Calpine is better than the Red River Valley?
I think Calpine's better than Red River Valley. Over the first initial 20-year contract life, in just in every year, the Calpine will be lower cost than the Red River Valley unit based on my analysis. It's not until after the contract term ends that we see the Red River Valley unit creating some substantial benefits and bringing the result closer together. And that doesn't start until 2037. And that's based on an assumption that the Calpine contract will have to be replaced with an expensive brand new greenfield unit. When I looked at the possibility of the Calpine contract being extended, then it started to display clear economic superiority over the Red River Valley unit.
And that's under the PVSC. Would that change at all with the PVRR?
No, I don't believe it will.
What's included in the PVSC that is not included in the PVRR exactly?
It's going to be those CO2 prices. And then there's also a small amount of cost assigned to NOx, PM10, lead, and carbon monoxide.
Where do those numbers come from?
Those are established by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission.
Where does Red River, you're in resource planning, correct?
Yeah, yes, sir.
Where's Red River Valley 2 fit in right now in the resource planning?
I like the Red River Valley concept. I think Black Dog is about the last site that we can develop from a brownfield perspective. It looked really good. It had all the transmission and gas we needed. We thought that, and it had land becoming available with retirement of units, so we thought that was a really good-looking place. But moving forward, I think the Red River Valley campus, whether at the originally proposed Hankinson or if we, you know, the gas pipeline development changes, if it can be moved closer to Fargo, I think is probably going to remain at the company's four of our preferred projects moving forward. I don't see this proposing a new baseload plant anytime soon. I don't see us moving to combined cycle, and even if we did move to combined cycle, a Red River site could easily support a combined cycle type project. So I think Red River Valley 1 and 2 are going to continue to be, you know, at the fore of our next company build preferred projects. It just so happens that, and I think this is good, we're in a competitive process right now. A competitive process is going to ensure the least cost for our customers, and quite frankly, we just got some really, really strong competition, especially from this Calpine plant that's in a really unique economic position that it's half built already, and it just needs to do a little bit more to get a lot more power out of it.
Yeah, and the reason I had asked specifically though about Red River Valley 2 is that's one of the projects here today, and it's really not showing up anywhere on the plans 1 through 20 or anything, is it going to be built?
Yeah, I think it's maybe a little bit misguiding to look at these top 20 plans and not see it. Here's the situation. The way we set up our model and the way these top 20 plans were created was based on our resource need assessment, which showed a small need in 2017 growing to that 307 by 2019. And we don't think we could get Red River Valley developed by 2017. That means it had to be combined with something else. And when you combine it with something else, either Black Dog or the other PPAs, by the time you build one of those three plus Red River Valley 1, Red River Valley 2 is really more capacity than the model was needing. That's why you're not seeing it in any of these top 20 plans. If we had maybe put in a different resource need that showed that we didn't need capacity until 2018, I think you'd see Red River Valley 2 somewhere in these rankings. I don't think they'd be right at the top, but I think you'd start seeing them in there. And after we build Red River Valley 1, Red River Valley 2 will be much more attractive. Red River Valley 1 has to bear some of the incremental upfront cost of developing the land, getting the site, getting the transmission, getting the gas. So once Red River Valley 1 is built, Red River Valley 2 becomes much more attractive.
I assume resource planning involves considerations of where to locate generation.
Somewhat. Our main driver is meeting our peak customer demand, plus the MISO required reserve margin. In a resource plan, we are fairly silent on the issue of specific locations. we really think that it's more this type of process, a competitive acquisition process, where you have actual projects on the table, where that discussion happens a little bit more.
I think there's been a lot of discussion today about a desire anyway, or some discussion in the past, whatever have you, about locating some generation in North Dakota. You've heard that, correct?
Correct.
Where does that fit in your job?
Actually, it would fit within this context. If in this resource acquisition process, if we had identified, abnormally high outages in the Fargo area that we thought could be resolved by additional generation in the area, we would be, much more strongly advocating that you have to move beyond this PVRR look. There's regional, local reliability issues that we have to tackle here. And we would have been much more forceful about that. But the fact that, we're just not seeing, rolling brownouts, or we haven't had, the town lost due to an ice storm. So we just couldn't, make that justification that its reliability in Fargo is really good, but we want to make it really, really good. We just had a hard time making that case.
What is your closest generation to Fargo?
I wouldn't know off the top of my head. I'm sorry. It wouldn't surprise me if we answered that in discovery at some point.
I think Mr. Alders referred this question to you, but I had asked him if with the Invenergy plus the Calpine, if during negotiations those prices got so low that if those two could maybe take over Black Dog. Do you recall when I asked him that?
I do.
Have you modeled that?
We haven't. In the modeling process thus far, we have modeled the PPAs at the price as was bid. I don't expect there to be that much change in the PPA prices. If there's a change, I only expect it to be 5 to 10 cents per kW month, which would result in maybe $1 million change. The intention really is that the prices in the final PPAs will look very, very close to the prices that are in the PPAs as currently offered. What we're really going to be negotiating around is more terms and conditions, very adjustments in the in-service date and things like that. We don't expect the prices of the PPA to change much, if at all.
Can you explain what's happening with the reserve margin at MISO?
I can try. 2 years ago, MISO proposed a very fundamental change to the way they calculate your reserve margin. We used to apply a certain percentage to our peak customer demand. That changed. What we now do is apply a different percentage to our customer's demand at the time when MISO as a whole entire region is hitting its peak customer demand. And through a historic analysis, we identified that our load is actually 5% down off our peak when MISO is hitting its peak. That essentially allowed us to reduce our reserve margin by about 5%. And consequently, it was a reduction of on the order of about 300 megawatts of capacity need. It's one of the benefits that MISO actually promised when we joined. The concept was if we all pool our resources together, each one of us individually don't have to carry as much backup because we can share it. And it's actually a MISO promise come to fruition. Since that time, we went through one summer of that last summer, and recently they completed their annual reserve margin analysis and have since increased the reserve margin requirement by 1%. Doesn't sound like a whole lot, but if you have a 10,000 megawatt system, that's 100 megawatts right there. So they came down one large step, and now they're taking a little tick back up.
Nothing further.
Commissioners, Chairman Koch.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your testimony. The follow-up a little bit on what Mitch was just talking about. So the MISO changing things as they go along, and that's just the way it goes. How do you anticipate when MISO South gets fully integrated, how this might change what you were just talking about?
Yeah, I'm not totally up to speed on how the rules are going to be implemented, whether we'll have to have a, whether we're supposed to be coincident with just MISO North or with MISO as a whole, because the transmission link between MISO North and MISO South is pretty weak. Right. So my expectation is that they'll probably separate them. And if that's the case, we wouldn't have much change at all.
But if transmission is built between the two, that would benefit.
That would probably further diversify the system, lowering our reserve margins potentially, yes.
Okay. And Mitch and Ryan actually did a very good job of asking most of the questions that I had. Grand Forks, we haven't talked much about Grand Forks. That's a big load area for you. How does the power get in and out of Grand Forks? You talked about Fargo having a lot of paths in there.
And I looked at a transmission map of, I'm not a transmission expert, but I did look at a transmission map of the Grand Forks area, and it does have multiple transmission lines in and out. It's definitely not on the end of just one radial line. I counted about four large transmission lines going in and out of Grand Forks.
Okay. And then it was interesting, you brought up, and the viewpoints are always different, of course, about reliability in Fargo not being an issue when it was a huge issue in the last rate case we had. And so it's interesting how different parts of the company look at things differently, because it was such a big issue that we end up giving Xcel a lot more money to install these IntelliTeam switches, and the Xcel has agreed to certain triggers to give customer rebates. So I would view reliability in Fargo as a big issue.
And I think it is different parts of the company view reliability in different ways. My understanding is that, well, my perspective functions on a generator and a transmission level. Once you get down to the distribution level, that's where my job responsibilities really stop.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, and I think most of the reliabilities, from what I understand, that have been occurring in the Fargo area are really are associated with the local distribution system, the lines running down your alley and things like that.
That's a fair point. Okay. I think I'm tracking the discussion about the aggressive DSM programs. You're saying that there's not a lot more going forward. You've really got what you call most of the low-hanging fruit right now?
That's a concern that's on our radar. We've always had very aggressive DSM goals, and we've always achieved those goals. And I think we've always even set the expectation that we'll even achieve more than our target. And
how do you set that? Is there some goal that you've been given by Minnesota on DSM, like the renewables, or
as part of the resource planning process? There is a state goal set forth in the Next Generation Act, but it's really a function in the resource planning process. We try to estimate how much DSM do we think we can achieve. What are the cost impacts of that going to be, and is that a good or not good deal for our customer? That's a high level. And then we do a 3-year plan that's a lot more detailed that looks like, okay, resource plan set a target of about 50 megawatts. The 3-year plan will go program by program by program, cost and benefit analysis of each one of those programs to lay out how we're going to meet that 50.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Christman.
When you talked about power purchase agreements, at one point you mentioned making an assumption that at the end of 20 years the power purchase agreements would be renewed another 10 years. What price did you figure on those?
That is a sensitivity test that we did, and all the PPAs that we've been offered have a gradually increasing monthly charge, and we assume that it continued to increase at its current escalation rate. So if at the end of the contract it was $10 per kW month escalating at 2%, we just kept on that 2%.
Is that how you figure maintenance and repair costs on facilities that you own? That it'll always just keep escalating at the same rate? Or is there a different way of looking at that where it curves and as they get older, the costs are going to go up?
Actually, I have kind of the counter expectation when it comes to PPAs. At the end of 20 years, my understanding is that the plants will largely be paid for by the independent power producer. If it's Calpine, their book value will be fully depreciated. They will have recovered the cost to construct the thing. And so they'll have essentially a free plant sitting there. But going back to your specific question about how we do it for our own plants, we do have a small regular escalating assumption for regular maintenance, but we also include periodic overhauls. So you'll see our costs for an own plant kind of decline over time as it gets older. We'll put in a major overhaul, so it's kind of this sawtooth pattern, actually.
At some point, the maintenance cost must start to rise, or you wouldn't only figure 20 or 30 years life expectancy. It would just seem to me.
I think I understand what you're saying. At some point, it becomes uneconomic to replace, I believe. But I don't believe that's within the 20-year window. I believe it's considerably further beyond. We pointed to a few plants earlier that are now, I guess I'm 40, so they must be 40-some too. And they're still operating and serving our system.
Do you agree with Mr. Weishert's the way he phrased the answer, that it's extremely unlikely scenario where construction of new generation in the Fargo area would enhance the local reliability of the power grid?
I think it's my perception is that it won't have a significant improvement. My perception is that whenever you add either more transmission lines coming in even, or local generation coming in, or local programs to control load directly, contracting with, you know, large industrial customers to have them reduce their load if something bad happens, any of those measures can enhance the local reliability. But I think we're in agreement that the incremental enhancement to any kind of reliability might be, you know, too small to justify the economic investment.
So now you say it's too small to justify the economic investment, but I believe this is your testimony in Minnesota talking about the fact that the Red River Valley units compare favorably to the Calpine and Invenergy proposals. And then going on to say, an additional consideration is that the company currently does not have generation resources located near its load centers in North Dakota. Construction of new generation in the Fargo area would enhance the local reliability of the power grid. That sounds like a whole different answer than what you just gave me.
I did agree that adding generation would enhance reliability. And I have to say, since I've been in this position about year and three quarters, and one of the first things I did is come up here to testify on the Prairie Rose matter, and I've received the message loud and clear that generation in North Dakota is important, natural gas generation near your load centers are important, and we're trying to carry that message forward for you.
Did you deliver that message? And then they told you, no, forget that message, and here's the message you send back to North Dakota? Because, like I say, now it sounds like a different story than what I read earlier.
No. In my testimony, the point I was trying to get across is that, well, all these, you know, options are fairly good. These are all fairly close together. This is a fairly close space competitive process. But what I couldn't say in my testimony is that I can justify that extra incremental year-by-year cost over the first 20 years for Red River Valley just for local reliability reasons. I couldn't make that economic justification. Doesn't say that if you don't add generation near load, it doesn't enhance things. But my message was that if asked, I would have said, I can't justify spending that extra money to build Red River Valley just in the name of local reliability, because we believe reliability in our Fargo area from a transmission and generation perspective is fairly strong at this point.
No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay. Got a variety of questions, Steve, so bear with me.
Not a problem.
I think I'll start with these resource need assessment tables. There's a few of them, and I am I think I'm looking at the most recent one, which is probably the one we should look at from September of 2013. It was updated from your original testimony. And I've got one on the Alders supplemental. So the stuff, I think this is what he filed on November 14th, and it's page 7. But I also have from yours, this is from the Minnesota docket, and it's page 4 of yours, and it goes back, it starts a little sooner. So
yes.
It includes 2016. So anyway, what I'm looking at is the I'm just curious about a couple of things, and it'll help me better understand how you guys use this. But you break down the – this is your estimated demand, right, or load? This is what you estimate needing.
Yes. The top line is our peak customer demand, and then the second portion below it is the resources we think we'll have to meet that load.
Okay. So how do you break those down? Because I see that over time the gas goes from – in 2017, it drops a little.
We had a little. Just so everybody's on the same page, we're looking at page 6 of 98 in the upper left-hand corner. That's the Wishart direct testimony, page 4 on the bottom.
Well, that'll work too.
Yeah.
I'm actually looking at page 7 of the Alders supplemental.
Which is page 9 of 98 for some reason.
It is? Not of mine.
Well, it's 7 down in the bottom, and then it's 9 of 98 in the upper left-hand.
Oh, there are
two. Oh, they're all over the place.
Okay, just so we're all on the same.
Okay,
page.
So anyway, I'm looking at the gas line. And it's showing 2017. It drops a little bit, and then I'm surprised more by the wind, hydro, and bio that drops. You know, almost 50 megawatts or so more. How do you guys decide this? What's going to how you split these up among those various?
Sure.
Resources.
The changes that you're seeing in that table mm-hmm. are really a reflection of the capacity accreditation that MISO gives us. Oh. Every spring we go through a process where MISO looks at the tested unit rating, which can vary by several megawatts per year. And then MISO also has a reliability rating that it also applies to it, known as UCAP. So I think the changes that you're seeing are really a reflection of differences in the rated capacity and the UCAP, and specifically under that wind hydro bio, we had a Goodhue wind PPA that was on the table at the time, but in between those two loads and resource analysis, the project was canceled. So I think that would account for some of that drop too.
Okay. And then is this where we see the line on solar, the solar mandate? You guys are just assuming you have to have this online there?
Correct. That was our preliminary first cut of what we think the accredited capacity will be associated with that solar mandate. Similar to wind, because it's a variable generation resource, it doesn't count for 100%. Mm-hmm. Wind's at about 13. We think solar will be about 50%.
Okay. Okay. Then, moving to this page 39, that chart with the sensitivity testing on the PVSC. It's page 39 of your Wishart direct is what it says on the bottom. Mm-hmm. On top, page 41 of 98. So you've got the low gas assumption. You talked about the high gas assumption in Calpine, on the scenario two being, you know, a money saver under high gas. But it also looks to me like it's expensive with low gas. So most of the predictions are for low gas. Why would you put so much emphasis on the high gas being like an important consideration when it's more expensive with low gas?
You're right. It's a symmetric relationship. And that's why, you know, we tend to gravitate to the base case first, because that's in the median. Maybe it might be just a reflection of when I started resource planning. I started when we were going through those severe natural gas price spikes. I remember the dissatisfaction from our customers when gas was that expensive and we didn't have anything to do to control it. So you're right, it's a symmetrical relationship. It's just as possible gas is low as gas is high. So I guess it's more, you know, reflection of personal experience.
Well, if you were to look at most of the predictions, I think it's not just as likely that gas is going to be high versus low. Most people are suggesting it's going to be low.
We do. We use
banking a lot on that.
Yeah. we do consult with three national forecasting agencies. They have big national models of not just electricity, but the entire energy system. And we use an average of those three different forecasts to develop our median, which is in the base forecast. So I think we are taking into account different perspectives on high versus low.
Okay. And then just so I understand the differences here a little bit too, under the zero CO2 column, why is Calpine not as competitive as the Red River Valley? So 2 versus 5, why is that? What's different about those projects?
You know, well, the difference between the Invenergy and the Calpine and why you see a bigger difference under the zero CO2 scenario, Calpine's an intermediate combined cycle unit, meaning we expect it to operate, you know, up to 35% of the hours. Invenergy Cannon Falls is a peaker. We expect that to operate much less, maybe 5%, maybe less. The difference in where that energy comes from is primarily made up from MISO market purchases that we have simulated in our model. And MISO market purchases, because MISO is a predominantly coal system, it looks like it has a high coal-type emission rate. So under the base case, the Calpine contract helps to avoid some of that CO2 and looks relatively closer. Under the zero CO2, the model is not recognizing the avoidance of that MISO energy purchase, and therefore Calpine looks more expensive relative.
Okay. All right. In some of this testimony, I read that Calpine or Invenergy, one of them uses fuel oil.
Invenergy Cannon Falls does have a fuel oil backup system. They have two existing units that currently operate off the existing fuel oil tank. This will be a third unit, and they haven't specified any additional tankage. So now we have three units sharing a tank that was originally designed for two. So we didn't give that a whole lot of credit in the analysis.
So how does the fuel oil affect the costs, the environmental issues, all of that? I mean, is that a viable long-term?
No, it's only used as a backup fuel in case of only emergencies. It's a primary gas unit. It'll burn natural gas 99% of the time. Kind of like having a fuel oil backup there just in case something goes really wrong with the natural gas system.
Got it. Also, Calpine and Invenergy have unidentified transmission costs, or just one of them?
Invenergy has the transmission issue. Calpine, because it's mostly built constructed plant, I think it's looking in really good shape from a transmission perspective. Invenergy Cannon Falls does have to go a few miles, and they're going to have to figure out some right-of-way issues to get their plant in and connected. And they have proposed to pass those costs through to customers, and that's one of the things we're going to strongly oppose through negotiations. If they're going to be ones making the profit off the projects, we want them to take all the risk.
And so if customers are going to be paying for that, will you be rerunning the models to see if that's still the lowest cost option?
Our position is going to start off being your price is what it is. We don't like this provision. Just take it out. So that's going to be our baseline negotiations. If they, you know, say they propose a price increase to take out that provision, we have the Calpine project sitting there as a second stalking horse, and then we also have Red River Valley. So I think we're in a strong negotiating position with Calpine to win on that one.
Okay.
Or Invenergy, rather.
And is Invenergy, where does the energy from Calpine and Invenergy currently go? Those are independent power producers.
Correct. And they're currently under long-term PPAs with us. Those were signed up in the early 2000s.
Okay. And so the one that's half-built, if you guys don't do this, then what happens?
We have a contract for the first 350 megawatts of it. It operates fine. and our contract with them would continue on as is.
They just won't expand.
They just won't expand, correct.
Are there any other extra costs that aren't included in the power purchase agreement that customers might have to pay for on those proposals?
No, we've been trying to thoroughly review the proposals and try to be very comprehensive about identifying all the costs that could potentially be associated with these. Outside the contract costs, there are net gas delivery charges. The typical arrangement is that even for an independent power producer, we're in charge of supplying the natural gas. We developed internal cost estimates for that and assigned them to the projects. But other than that, there wouldn't be any additional costs from these projects.
The fuel cost is included as a set price, or
the fuel cost is two components. One is the commodity, just kind of every unit of gas you take. We include that in the model, and then there's an annual fixed charge for kind of the supply line. We've included that too.
Okay. All right, a couple other questions here. If you sign these one or both of these power purchase agreements, and you turn out not needing the extra power from the Black Dog unit that you're going to convert, what will you do with that unit, the coal unit that needs to be shut down? And
the coal unit needs to be shut down. Irrespective of what the outcome of this is, EPA signed or established the MATS rule, mercury and other air toxins rule, which is going to force shutdown of that unit in early 2015, spring of 2015 to be precise, and that's going to happen no matter what. We mentioned the analysis earlier. The cost of retrofitting a 1950s vintage small coal plant located in a metro area with the necessary equipment to comply was much higher than any kind of replacement cost. So that's going to move forward no matter what.
Is there some efficiencies gained by converting it to gas?
We did look at retrofitting that unit to gas a little bit. It'd essentially be, like melting or boiling a pot of water on your stove. It'd be very inefficient and very inflexible. So we did look at that, but we didn't think that'd be a viable option from a cost-effectiveness perspective.
Then this is just a little more forward-thinking, but in our last discussion with your company on the power purchase agreements, we talked about the need around the corner, maybe 5 years from now, of replacing some of your baseload units. How much are you looking at that with this in looking, like, bigger at the long term of starting with, say, a CT in the Red River Valley that could be converted to a combined cycle, bigger plant down the road that fits all of those needs?
It has more
of the expandable capabilities.
That's an interesting perspective. We recently did do a big study on our Sherco 1 and 2 baseload coal plants. Those would probably be first in line of anything that would be retired. The conclusion coming out there is there's no compelling reason to retire those right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect significant federal carbon legislation that would require those to shut down anytime soon. So that it really did not play into this analysis a whole lot. We were operating on the assumption that those units are going to be online for the foreseeable future. But in the event that something does happen to those units, either NOx regulations or CO2 regulations, we could quickly move to building a combined cycle at Red River Valley, whether we had one existing CT already or not. Actually, the most cost-effective thing would probably be to build it all in one fell swoop. So that staged approach is something that's feasible, but I don't know it would buy us a whole lot of economics.
Okay. And then I think, can you be more specific at all about the load growth? You said your load growth is growing in your entire system, but you didn't and most as a percentage wise in South Dakota, but talk a little bit about what you know about what's happening in North Dakota.
In North Dakota, I believe we do file a 10-year annual report with North Dakota that lists our projections of peak demand growth in North Dakota. I believe the peak demand growth is about 0.5% per year. And on the basis of North Dakota being about 5% of our load, that will translate into 60 or 70 megawatts worth of demand growth over the next 10 years.
And do you know when was the last time you made, where, what year are those numbers from?
That would have been filed yet earlier this year. I think okay. it was a July filing.
All right. And then Ms. McCartan talked a little bit about the, you know, if we were to make some ruling based on reliability, or that we would need a fully developed reliability record. What would that be?
You know, to we would want to establish the fact that somehow the reliability in the region's lacking. We would look at historic outage data for our load centers in North Dakota, and we would have to disentangle what was distribution level versus what was transmission and generation. And we'd have to compare that to other areas on our system, Twin Cities area, Wisconsin, et cetera. I think you would need that type of information to be able to establish the fact that reliability in the region is somehow lacking and needs to be addressed.
Okay. All right. That concludes my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, commissioners, anything else? Mr. Chairman Calk.
Just a couple more. Thank you for your time.
No problem.
Just very direct questions, I guess. The you were talking about it's hard to justify the increased cost for local reliability. Okay, that's what you said. But how do I justify to North Dakota ratepayers the increased cost North Dakota pays for renewable energy standards in Minnesota, Minnesota's Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Project, Minnesota's community-based energy development programs? How do I justify those to North Dakota customers?
That's a good question, Commissioner. We comply with the rules that are given us to the best and least cost of our abilities.
It only works one way, though.
Is there a rule that you've established for us that we haven't complied with?
There may be an order when we're done here that says that.
Is that what it takes? Well, the best we can do is try to comply with the rules that are given to us in the least cost fashion.
That's fair. That's a fair statement. The rules that you're given in the least cost. So then the next thing is that, do you think it's fair, equitable treatment perhaps, that North Dakota pays 5% everything and there's no generation in this jurisdiction?
I think that the electrons we deliver to our North Dakota customers are just as reliable as electrons that we delivered all over our service territory, not only Minneapolis, but also Wisconsin and a little bit of Michigan.
Did you know that North Dakota was the only state that you didn't have generation in before today?
Oh, I was well aware of that. We've been receiving your message for a while.
No, but I mean, doesn't that just seem odd?
No, there's lots of places in America that are served by transmission.
Given the amount of generation that's available in North Dakota, from the full suite of coal to wind to natural gas to hydro, the most energy-rich state in your service area, and you still don't have generation here?
I think you make a point that you are energy-rich. I mean, just because we don't own the generation doesn't mean there's not generation in the region that the electrons are actually flowing to our customers. The way the grid is interconnected, it doesn't necessarily have to be our unit to add to the reliability of our customers in North Dakota. It's all interconnected, so as long as there is generation, I think there is a generation reliability benefit there.
That's a fair point. So you'd put it back the other way, saying that there's so much generation here that you can have access to it through shared contracts like you serve up in Minot?
It's a similar concept, yes. I mean, it wouldn't make – if there was a big coal plant right next to Fargo that was reliably serving Fargo, even though we didn't own it, it wouldn't make much sense for us to build a redundant duplicate plant right next door.
We do have a transmission constraint from central North Dakota to eastern North Dakota.
Central North Dakota, eastern North Dakota.
So it's not as easy as our energy.
Right. It's not that we can export energy from Bismarck right over to –
correct.
Understood.
But back to what you said before, I'll make sure that I'm – semi-clear in what you said. You said you'd do your best. The company does its best to do the least cost given the rules it must follow.
That's true, and we've also heard your message. I mean, we've taken your message about North Dakota Generation very seriously. It worked really hard to develop the...
If this order comes out and it says that you will do this by this time, how much weight will that carry? I mean, will you then comply with it? Or will you just say, no, we ain't going to do it?
I don't believe that's my call. Like you said, I recommend decisions. I don't make them at the company, unfortunately.
Who should I ask that question to that's here today? Then I get back to Laura then to say...
I think Laura would be the most appropriate. I know we would take it seriously. I know we
don't
would
shoot
bring
the
it
messenger.
Forward.
That wasn't my goal here, but I wanted to. I just been quiet all morning, and I'm not quiet anymore. So thank you.
Sure.
You can quiet.
Commissioner Christman, do you have additional questions? Okay, Mr. Zimser, any follow-up?
Just some minor issues for the record, Your Honor. Mr. Wishart, would it be possible to provide some of the same data here with the externality items deleted just to make sure we have a complete record as a late filed exhibit?
Absolutely, it would. Maybe take a week to get together the data, but we could file that for sure.
And we'd propose to enter that as a late filed exhibit.
I don't think there's any objection to that. Okay. Anything else?
Just one more question. Mr. Wishart, when you do your resource planning on the system, you essentially assume deliverability wherever you may locate the generation system wide. Is that a fair assumption?
When we do our resource planning process, correct, we use generic units that are assumed to be able to deliver to anywhere in our service territory.
And if there are problems with deliverability, that's when you start addressing other measures?
Correct. If there's a local reliability issue, then that'll be handled fairly separately.
And as of right now, as you do your resource planning for the system, you aren't aware of any within North Dakota?
Correct. Moving into our next resource planning phase, we wouldn't identify reliability in the North Dakota region as a critical factor that needed special issues to address.
And so from a resource planning perspective, would that mean that you would look to try to find the most cost-effective generation you can find, and if that would be in North Dakota, then you would locate resources in North Dakota?
Absolutely. Without specific, local issues that are, needed to be addressed, then we would go least cost first.
All right. I have nothing further.
Mr. Norrell, any questions?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No.
Okay, Mr. Wishart, you can step down. I think we'll take about a 10-minute break here. As I understand it, we still have two more NSP witnesses. Is that correct?
We have Mr. Ford in reserve and then Ms. McCartan, if the commission would like to speak to her.
Okay. All right, 10 minutes.
And Ryan, you just Mike's your only witness?
Yes.